Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And very many thanks for joining us here on Africa Link. My name is Abubakar Jallo, coming to you live from Bonn, Germany. Here's what we've lined up for you. Tense moment in Gabon as the Electoral Commission delay announcement of the presidential election results.
The whole electoral system in Gabon is built in a way that make it easy for Bongo to remain in power if he chooses to do so, regardless whether he actually won or lost the election.
The rights group Human Rights Watch is urging Southern African countries to increase respect for human rights, and Rwanda has begun shutting down orphanages and placing orphans with foster families.
There were 33 orphanages and 3,325 children countrywide when we started this. Today, we have closed 14 orphanages and 2,294 children have been adopted.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
Gabon is bracing up for the announcement of the presidential election result, which is hotly disputed between bitter rivals President Ali Bongo and his main challenger, Jean Ping. The Electoral Commission was scheduled to release the result on Tuesday evening, but up to this morning, the panel was still in a closed-door meeting. So what awaits the new leader of a country rich in minerals, but with a very bad-performing economy? My colleague Isaac Pogabi put that question to Omar Ba, a political analyst based in the United States.
I think the incoming president will face a lot of challenges, but those may be different depending on who wins the election. Bongo is already hugely unpopular. Let's remember that in 2009, he won the elections with only 42% of the votes, and his family has been ruling the country for the past half a century. So if you are Gabonese and you are 50 years old or younger, you have lived basically your whole life under the rule of this single family. That's one of the challenges. Also, when Bongo came in power in 2009, he had promised to diversify the economy. Gabon isn't doing well, economically speaking. Unemployment is still very high. There has been a cut in funding for social services because of the diminution of the prices of oil, for example. And for a country that is only about 1.7 million people, it is not understandable how it can be so rich in natural resources, but still at the same time, the population being so poor. Ping himself isn't totally new. For many years, he has been minister in the government for many years. He was Omar Bongo's son-in-law. So it is not totally a new political class that will come to power.
Despite Gabon having vast natural resources like oil and other minerals, the majority of its people still live in abject poverty. Why?
It has to do with the fact that the economy hasn't been diversified, but also it has to do with the way in which the Bongo family has ruled the country since 1967. It was all built on a patronage system where the family and the ruling class has access to all these funds that derives from the sale of oil and timber. But there hasn't been any sort of investment that would drive the economy outside of those revenues from the natural resources.
Isn't it then high time that the Bongo dynasty or family, if you will, ended its dominance of the country's politics?
It is possible that we are witnessing change of an era. We are witnessing maybe a new era in Gabonese politics, but it is still not sure because the whole electoral system in Gabon is built in a way that make it easy for Bongo to remain in power if he chooses to do so, regardless whether he actually won or lost the elections.
And do you think Jean Ping's participation in the presidential election as a former diplomat and chair of the African Union Commission has brought fresh breath in Gabon's politics?
It is true that Ping has an international aura. He has been at the head of the AU. He has been a Gabonese foreign minister for many years, so he has international credential to be the new president. But also at the same time, what helped Ping is that he was able to rally behind him a lot of former allies in Bongo's ruling party. Just a few months ago, the president of the National Assembly himself left office and joined the opposition and is now one of allies of Ping.
Political analyst Omar Ba. Let's now join Ole Tangen Jr. and Wanjiku Mwaura with further information on Gabon's main politicians Ali Bongo and Jean Ping.
Gabon, a small West African country, has been ruled by the same family for the past 48 years. Omar Bongo Ondimba was the president of Gabon for 42 years, beginning in 1967, 7 years after the country became independent from France. He was the president until his death in 2009. The current president, Ali Bongo Ondimba, succeeded his father after winning the presidential election in 2009. Many members of the opposition disputed the results, but the Constitutional Court upheld them. The election was followed by looting on a wide scale, especially in the capital, Libreville.
Jean Ping is the son of a Chinese immigrant and his Gabonese mother, and is the former head of the African Union Commission. Prior to that, he worked for UNESCO and also served as the director of the civil cabinet under the incumbent president, Ali Bongo. He left the ruling Gabonese Democratic Party in 2014 and later launched his candidacy for president. Many Gabonese hope that his former role as an AU diplomat will help change the image of the country's leadership.
Prior to the release of the results, observers from the European Union stated that the election was, quote, managed in a way that lacked transparency, and both sides have been accusing the other of fraud. There are reports that residents have been stocking up on water and food in case violence breaks out.
According to figures from the World Bank, Gabon has a population of 1.7 million. With its vast oil reserves, it has one of the highest per capita incomes in Africa at $11,500 or 10,200 euros. Almost four times that of Nigeria, which even as Africa's biggest economy has a GDP of around $3,000. But Gabon has come under criticism because many claim that most of the revenue from oil and other mineral exports have been steered into the pockets of a small political and business elite.
Gabon has witnessed some unrest recently with public sector strikes and thousands of layoffs in the oil sector. The collapse in the price of oil has hit the Gabonese economy hard. Because of this, a third of Gabon's population currently live in poverty, and unemployment among young people stands at 35%. Analysts say that the country needs to diversify its economy, or it will continue to struggle unless oil prices rise.
Wanjiku Mwaura and Ole Tangen Jr. And you're listening to DW's Africa Link from Bonn, Germany.
News, analysis, and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
The rights group Human Rights Watch has urged the Southern African Development Community, SADC, to take concrete steps in improving respect for human rights among its 15 member states. The body says political repression and disregard for basic rights increased among SADC member countries over the past year. Now, Deva Mavinga led the investigation into these abuses and spoke to Isaac Mugabe.
There is a close relationship between perceptions by the ruling elites in Southern Africa about threats to their political power and a rise in human rights abuses. So I'll give an example of Zimbabwe, where because of the economic difficulties, citizens are complaining, and when they complain, the ruling elite, the government, views that as a threat and takes steps to crush any dissenting voices, thereby spiking or triggering a rise in human rights abuses. Also, when the cake gets smaller, it is the ruling elites who seek to apportion for themselves. So you have a rise in corruption, which is met by a proportional decrease in the standard of living and in the securing of social and economic rights.
In other words, you're saying that SADC countries have backtracked on their core values and objectives, like enhancing the standard and quality of life of their people. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. And not only that, you have SADC countries that have got fairly progressive constitutions that protect rights. But the reality on the ground is that they have long ceased to genuinely care about those rights, because it appears there is a prioritization which puts political considerations above the general welfare of the people.
In recent days here at Africa Link, we've reported on the media situation in countries like Zambia and Tanzania, which seems to be deteriorating each day that goes by. How do you intend to engage the leadership of these two countries in promoting media rights and freedoms?
Well, what we're saying is that there must be effort at all levels. So what we're saying is that one area to focus on is the SADC leadership to press these countries to comply with their own commitments to human rights respect, which begin with their own constitutions. You will know that African leaders are fond of this mantra that says African solutions to African problems. So we are also saying African institutions must speak out and lead in the charge to defend human rights. But also, for countries like Zambia and Tanzania, we are saying they must not view respect for human rights as a way of undermining authority, but they must view it as a way of ultimately improving the quality of life of the people. Because if you secure social and economic rights, if you secure civil and political rights, it means the more human rights are abused, the less secure the government becomes.
How can you describe working relations between Human Rights Watch and SADC countries in the attempt to address human rights issues?
What our modus operandi is that we investigate human rights abuses, we document them, we expose them, and then we call for action for positive change. So in as far as we do that, we always make sure that we engage with the governments in question. So it's a mixed bag, but we would want to see a more positive outlook and relationship between Human Rights Watch and Southern African countries.
They were Mavinga from Human Rights Watch, and we apologize for the poor quality of the phone line.
Behind the headlines.
Now, Rwanda has launched a campaign to phase out all orphanages in the country. Under the slogan, "Let's raise them in families," the government is encouraging well-to-do Rwandans to adopt orphans into their families. If successful, the initiative would make Rwanda the first country in the African continent without an orphanage. However, some Rwandans say the program needs to be implemented with very caution. Nasra Bishumba sent this report from Kigali.
I am at Gisimba Memorial Center, one of the oldest and well-known orphanages in Rwanda. For many years, this particular orphanage was home to many vulnerable children, and their excited voices while they played and ran around its vast compound augured well with the neighbors. But today, the silence that receives me is deafening. Gisimba Memorial Center still exists, but the children that kept the place lively are long gone. They have all been adopted by different families following government's decision to phase out orphanages and place the children in foster families. According to the Executive Secretary of the National Commission for Children, Dr. Claudine Uwera Kanyamanza, the decision to close the orphanages is aimed at giving vulnerable children a chance to live in a loving family and proper upbringing.
gahunda itangira hari ibigo 33.
There were 33 orphanages and 3,325 children countrywide when we started this. Today, we have closed 14 orphanages and 2,294 children have been adopted. About 1,184 children await adoption. When we talk of children, we are referring to those under 18. But these orphanages also had children who were brought here because of extreme disabilities and street children. Generally, these institutions do not have orphans only.
Kanyamanza also says that though the government is committed to placing children in homes, serious precautions were being followed to make sure that the children do not end up in the wrong hands.
We don't just give a child to anyone. We work with all levels of local authorities to vet the people interested in adopting children to really know who this person is and why they are interested in having a child. Normally, we want to know about their daily lifestyle and how they make a living. There is no time frame about the process. It depends on the family that has applied, because that also helps us to know how to support them.
Françoise Marekatete, the head of the Mental Health Department at the National Association of Women Genocide Survivors, AVEGA, told DW that there should be caution when placing children into foster families.
It's important to prepare the child. It's important to spend time talking to the child, showing them why it's better to live with a family, and why being in an orphanage doesn't benefit them, or give them opportunities to showcase their abilities. Because it's easier for someone to be helped in a small family setting than it is in a crowd of many children.
Some ordinary Rwandans that DW spoke to expressed mixed feelings about the initiative of closing down orphanages and placing children in foster families. Patricia Uwera is a local resident of Kigali. She told DW why she is skeptical.
I don't think that the program is bad, but I think they would have thought about it for some time before they started acting. Let us hope that they are not only words, that they are doing the follow-ups on the homes that they gave the kids to. They are putting it in action. And I also hope that the children are also continuing to go to school, having their health insurance and feeding the way they are supposed to.
A recent report released by a local NGO on the state of child protection in the communities highlighted illiteracy, ignorance, domestic violence, lack of family planning, and polygamy among the factors that have led to children not receiving enough care in their communities.
Nasra Bishumba reporting from Kigali. Our third installment of Tourism in Africa takes us this week to Ethiopia, a country that is suffering through a political crisis and a recurring drought. But it's also a place of fascinating ancient culture. One of its most impressive treasures is a series of rock cut churches in the north of the country, dating back to the 12th and 13th centuries. This report by Linda Staude is now presented by Natalie Müller.
A Sunday service is underway in the little mountain village of Lalibela. The repetitive chant of the faithful can be heard for miles across this arid yet starkly beautiful landscape in northern Ethiopia. Hundreds of Ethiopian Orthodox Christians are on a pilgrimage. They descend a steep, dusty road to one of the holiest places of their faith, hidden away in a rocky desert that feels like the middle of nowhere.
Most people and writers consider, the Rockham Church of Lalibela as one of the world wonders.
That's Mugi Kawende. He's proudly showing visitors around the 11 churches. Without him, strangers would be quickly lost in the breathtaking architecture. Every year, thousands of worshippers come to this so-called Ethiopian Jerusalem. Religious holidays like Christmas draw particularly big crowds. UNESCO made the rock-hewn churches a World Cultural Heritage Site in 1978, and roughly half of the 600,000 tourists who visit Ethiopia each year come here. The smell of incense fills the gloomy interior of the Beit Merhame Alem, the Church of the Redeemer. Carpets cover the undulating stone floor. A group of priests in white robes chant prayers. Eyes closed, they seem lost in devotion, even as crowds swarm around them. At 33 metres long and 11 metres high, the Church of the Redeemer is the biggest church anywhere in the world to have been carved from a single rock. Today, an incongruously shabby roof on metal struts protects the building, but it has survived well over the hundreds of years since its mysterious origins. According to legend, King Lalibela, the town's patron saint, created the magnificent building over a period of 23 years. Considering the tools that were available in the 12th century, constructing the churches certainly seems like a miracle. The architecture, intricate decoration, the complex drainage system, every detail had to be planned before the first strike of the chisel. And even today, the 11 churches perform miracles for the town. There's construction work going on everywhere in the bustling little town. New hotels and residential buildings rise up between traditional stores, souvenir shops, and modern bars. Outside the town, workers are surfacing a road leading up to a mountain village that, in the 12th century, was the capital of the Ethiopian Empire. And a new airport serving the area brings in visitors from other parts of the country.
The number of Ethiopian tourists is steadily increasing. The war and the Great Famine are behind us. Today, there's a middle class emerging.
This is Fesaha. He manages Lalibela's oldest hotel, the Seven Olives. As we depart, Abebe, the young man who's been guarding our shoes at each stop, returns them one last time. He says he also hopes to earn a good living from tourism one day.
At the moment, I'm still training. When I'm done with that, I'll be a tourist guide. Until then, I'll watch over the shoes and do what I have to make a living.
And that report was compiled by Linda Staude.
Opinion.
For Opinion this week, we would like to hear your thoughts on the elections in Gabon and what you think about the Bongo dynasty's dominance of politics. We would also want you to tell us what you think about Rwanda's campaign to close all orphanages in the country. Send us your thoughts or comment in a text message to +49 160 957 59510. You can also send us an email to feedback.africa@dew.com, or a letter can also do that, and the address is africalink@dew53110, Bonn, Germany. And news from elsewhere, Zimbabwe is gearing up for another national shutdown today. Civil rights organizations have called on citizens to stay at home to show their disagreement against President Robert Mugabe's government. Many say the government hasn't done enough to manage the economy. Economist is putting the employment rate in the country as high as 50%, but the government disagreeing, claiming that it's 40%. And also, the death toll from Somalia car bomb attack that took place on Tuesday has risen to 22, and the number of wounded also rose to 50, according to the police. And for more stories, go to our website, dw.com/Africa. And until tomorrow, my name is Abubakar Jallo in Bonn. Bye now.